This is a Historic England podcast, sponsored by Ecclesiastical Insurance Group.
Welcome to Irreplaceable, a history of England in 100 places. I'm Dr. Susanna Lipscomb, a historian from the University of Roehampton. And in this series, we're exploring the amazing places which have helped make England the country it is today. So how does it work? 10 categories, 10 expert judges, and thousands of your nominations will lead us to a list of 100 places that together tell England's story. If you're enjoying the series, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And if you're listening on iTunes, please rate this podcast and leave a review. So far in the series, we've heard about the places that have witnessed sporting triumphs, nation-shaping moments of loss, destruction, and conservation, and we've taken a tour around some of our best homes and gardens. Today, though, we begin our journey into the faith and belief category, where we'll explore the diverse story of belief in England. I'm joined in the studio by Historic England's Dr. Joe Flatman and journalists Ramona Ali and Hazel Southam. Hazel, you've been reporting on religious affairs across the world in the course of your career. So what do you think about England's religious story that makes it particularly exciting and distinctive?
I think because it's so long and because we live in it now, you feel the sense of the people who went before you. Now, if that's where I live in a city called Winchester, and I can almost reach out and touch the people who lived there and worshipped there before me. So that sense of being part of a continuum is really important to me.
And Ramona, your focus is on modern day faith and identity, but I see that you also have a master's in medieval studies. So you're in your element in this category, aren't you?
I love history. My mum always says I was born in the wrong century. So I feel very much connected to all types of histories from different cultures and traditions. And British history just absorbs so many of those. So it's a fascinating landscape for us to explore.
And Joe, of course, your very job is protecting heritage sites. So this is sort of very much your day-to-day, your bread and butter, isn't
Absolutely.
It? Well, our category judge for this is the Very Reverend Dr. David Ison, the Dean of St. Paul's Cathedral, and we'll be hearing his comments throughout the programme. And our first location takes us to a very important place in the history of England. We're about to step back more than 4,500 years to the foundation of a world-famous prehistoric monument. It is, of course, Stonehenge in the Wiltshire countryside. David explained why this has the honour of opening our faith and belief category.
It was the main prehistoric site in England, the one that's best known and internationally known. And it represents that tradition of how we interact with our landscape. So when you think about early man coming to this country, largely covered in woodland, nothing there, how do you make sense of the place, not only as somewhere to live, but also somewhere where you encounter what you believe in and how you express it? And so in the same way that with farming we've shaped the landscape, so with religion and belief we have shaped the landscape. And Stonehenge is a very good example of a huge amount of effort that's been put in to create something human and man-made, but put into a wider landscape setting, which together with the construction speak of the beliefs and hopes and aspirations of those people.
Stonehenge is surely best known for its impressive stone circle, which has been a place of significance and spirituality to humans for thousands of years. But as David said, the famous stone circle is just one part of a huge and ancient ceremonial landscape which was fundamental to the religious life of our ancestors. Even to this day, people come to Stonehenge for spiritual purposes and to connect with a place steeped in diverse mystery and meaning. We thought we'd head along to experience it for ourselves.
I'm Susan Greeney and I'm Senior Historian at English Heritage. We are at Stonehenge and we're at the Visitor Centre and we're standing in one of the reconstructed Neolithic houses that we've built here. And if we just step outside, we can have a little look at what that landscape looks like. And you can see it's this really wide, open, grassy landscape. It's quite unique and it's quite different. It's very typical of Wiltshire. In this landscape, we've got a huge number of prehistoric monuments. There's Stonehenge, obviously, right in the middle of the landscape. We've got some earthwork monuments from the early Neolithic period, so that's before Stonehenge was built. And we've also got some burial mounds, round barrows, from after Stonehenge was built. So there's about 2,000 years of prehistoric activity preserved in this landscape. We have a option for our visitors here. They can either get on our bus or they can walk across the landscape. And from here, you can walk out through some field gates and along the road a little way, and you can walk across this landscape along the line of the ancient Cursus Monument, which is a really early monument in this landscape. But today we're going to take the bus. Well, we're standing right at the entrance to Stonehenge. It's where we can see the most regular sarsen stones. They're the really big stones. And we can also see the lintels on top that join them together. And on this side, we've got three preserved lintels still in their original position. So it gives you a really good impression of what the stone circle would have looked like when it was completed back in prehistory. Looking around us here, we can see the rolling downland of the chalk landscape. And we can see spotted around in the landscape on some of the ridges around us, some low bumps, some low hills, and they're round barrows. They were built in the early Bronze Age and they cover the burials of people from that period. The thing I notice about Stonehenge is it's very different and different times of year and different times of day. So if you're here at dawn on a frosty morning, you get a completely different sense to if you're here in a rainstorm or here in midsummer when it's really hot and the parched grasslands all around you. And the stones look different in different lights. Sometimes they look very dark and silhouetted against the sky. Other times they're bright white and really shining. And other times they pick up the orange of the sun. So it's one of those sites that repays several visits to see it in different lights and different seasons. The entrance faces northeast, and that's where the heel stone is, this outlying stone. And that's the direction of the midsummer sunrise. So on the 21st of June, if you stand in the middle and you look in that direction, you will see the sunrise in exactly that direction. Conversely, on the 21st of December, in the shortest day of the year, if you turn 180 degrees and look out through the stones, in prehistory you would have seen the sun setting between the two tallest stones of the Great Trilithon at the head of the horseshoe. We have very few clues about what people were doing here in prehistory and what kind of ceremonies and rituals might have been carried out. But what we do know is how the stones are arranged, and that shows us that solstice axis is really, really important. And we also know there's not many finds here. There's not lots of pottery or animal bones or feasting debris. So it suggests it's kept clean and sacred and perhaps separate from everyday life. At the beginning of the 20th century, Druids first started to come to Stonehenge. And at the time, these were actually Christian, sort of friendly societies who were taking their name from the ancient Druids who had been recorded by classical authors. And they used Stonehenge for ceremonies. But over the 20th century, really, that's become its own religion. And there's lots of different facets of these modern religions. And in general, it's about a sense of connection with the British past, with the countryside, with the landscape, with our ancestors. And people come at all times of year to conduct ceremonies. People who are just generally spiritual like to come to Stonehenge and soak up the atmosphere. And it's always been a place that people have come to and stood and wondered about the past. And I think it will do for a very long time to come.
Fascinating to hear people visit this monument today for so many different reasons. It makes you realise that location and landscape and belief have a lot to do with each other. Today, I think we think about religious buildings and our relationship with worship. But of course, in this period, it would have been the landscape itself that held special significance. Jo, what do we know about the landscape before Stonehenge was constructed?
We've undertaken really extensive surveys over very many years in this area. And of course, nowadays, everyone experiences it as this very open grassland landscape. And it really does need to be emphasised, that sense of it being quite an unusual space with a lot of heavy woodland nearby. You've got the river not terribly far away, completely different from the kind of place you go to these days.
So, Joe, apart from the stone circle that we know, what else is there at Stonehenge?
Got a fantastic array of sites dotted all over that landscape. You've got the stone circle, obviously, but then you've got the avenue leading right off it, right aligned with the sunrise and the sunset at the solstices, which is obviously what an awful lot of visitors go and have that particularly special experience twice a year. Some people have always thought perhaps it is to do with some sort of sense of measuring time, or perhaps almost a celestial clock. It's much more of that sense of actually identity with the landscape, the seasons, the cycle, the pace of life.
And Ramona, this connection between religious sites and the natural world is something that has been important throughout history, isn't it?
Yes, and you really feel it when you're at Stonehenge. I mean, you feel the really otherworldliness, the mystery, the wonder of it all. And the connection to the sun and the environment is something that really speaks to me as well in my own faith tradition, because like the sun tells me when to pray, and we're also connected to the moon, the lunar cycle that tells us what, you know, it measures out our time. And we're so disconnected these days from our natural surroundings. And so going to Stonehenge really brings that back, that connection back to nature and to really the natural way of living. And so that was something that really had a huge impact on me when I went there.
The striking thing about Stonehenge, of course, is that it is an area that has clues to human life and settlement thousands of years ago. I mean, in fact, it's just being uncovered, but it's also, of course, a place of burial. And Hazel, why do you think burial sites and traditions are so important in the history of faith?
Well, because where you bury your dead and how you bury them is incredibly personal and important. It's important for you as a bereaved family, and it's important for the person who is going on into the next world. So it represents not only how you feel about them, but also what you hope for them for the future. And at Stonehenge, it's actually predated by a ditch, a structure, and in that they've found all kinds of things that show that there were burials there, both burials and cremations. So, you know, the burials there, why incredibly important. It's the biggest Neolithic burial site in the UK.
Yes, it's an important ritual, and I suppose that focus on the afterlife, which is the focus of much spiritual belief, is crucial
too. But also I think in a time of grief, you need a ritual, you need a form and a way of doing it that helps you get through it so that you can cope with what's happening.
You almost feel like they're speaking to you when you're there, like you can hear the ancestors, but I don't know if that was the audio guide, but I did feel very, very palpable.
But there is something about that though, isn't there? There's something tangible about the part. I always think this with historic houses, that you go into them and they're places where only time and not space separates you from the people of the past. And so many people, a million people or more, visit Stonehenge every year. And do you think there's something about that tangibility, that physical visiting of a place, that's really important?
Yes, and I think what Ramona said about that it connects you with the landscape and with the natural world is so important. And I'm sure a lot of people must get that out of it, because, you know, here we all are, we've got our phones and our iPads and every other bit of technology, but often we don't look up and see the sky or the stars or know exactly where the sun is rising or where it's setting, and we're not growing our own food generally, and we are completely disconnected. And in that disconnect you get disconnected from spirituality, and so going to a place that is so very physical reconnects you with that.
There's something really extraordinarily awesome about standing in front of these, isn't there, Joe? And it gives you that sense of connection to the natural and spiritual world.
Yeah, my personal advice is if anyone goes, they should walk it, because it is that sense of gradually coming up to the stones through the environment. It might be a hot summer's day, it might be a cold winter's day, getting closer and closer, ideally making sure that you have it one of the times you can actually go inside the circle and be there. And I personally actually like it when there's more people there. Some people like the idea of being there on their own, having the kind of exclusive visit. I like that sense of it being a bit bustling, a bit crowded, almost pilgrimage-like in that sense.
And I suppose when you're all those people, it gives you a sense of, you know, how small a human is compared to these stones, like 4 metres high, aren't they? They're sort of 25 tonnes. You get a human next to that and they look so arresting and impressive.
Yeah.
Well, now, from the southwest of England up to the northeast, we're now off to the outer edges of the country, relatively close to the Scottish border, in fact. 1 mile off the Northumberland coast, you'll find the wonderful island of Lindisfarne. And it's tiny. It's 4 miles by 1.5 miles and connected to the mainland by a spit that only is revealed at certain tide times. But while it may be small, it's a very special place. So the Reverend Dr. David Ison explained why Lindisfarne made his top 10.
Lindisfarne represents a whole strand of Christian faith and belief, which we call Celtic. It's also interesting here that Celtic spirituality has been revived in a modern and slightly different form. There's this ongoing sense of what it means. But if you're from the north of England in particular, you'll be very aware of the saints from the early Christian period who came over from Ireland or from Scotland and who evangelized the north of the country and down the east side of the country. So that tradition is kind of summed up in Lindisfarne as a place. It's been a consistent place of monastic occupation and prayer for a long period. It also indicates the way in which special places like islands, liminal places, that's places that are on the edge. So it's both an island and part of the mainland as the tide ebbs and flows. And it's an intriguing place that is sometimes one thing, sometimes another, which is also an image of our religious experience, that sometimes you're in the middle of ordinary life and then sometimes something touches you and changes you and you have a spiritual experience in the midst of life.
It's an excellent choice. Lindisfarne is the Anglo-Saxon name for a community otherwise known as Holy Island. And for good reason. The priory and monastery here were highly influential in the shaping of English Christianity. A priory was founded here around 634 when Irish monks settled on the island. But the island is perhaps most famous for the Lindisfarne Gospels, which were written here in the late 7th or early 8th century. They are beautiful, strikingly illuminated or illustrated manuscripts. They make up some of the finest pieces of medieval art and religious writing still in existence. They're now kept at the British Library in London. Lindisfarne has had a turbulent past. In 793, in the century after the Lindisfarne Gospels were produced, it faced an early Viking invasion, and later its 12th century monastic building became one of the first to be dissolved under Henry VIII's 1536 Act for the Dissolution of the Lesser Monasteries. After that, a modest castle was built here using the stones from the priory. As well as being a place intrinsically associated with Christianity in England, this is also a well-loved area of outstanding natural beauty. The dune lands and beaches are popular with bird watchers in both autumn and winter, as it's a great spot to watch the migrating flocks. You can also spot grey seals lolling on the shore here. It's a truly beautiful place. So let's start at the beginning. How did an Irish monk end up on this little island off the coast of North England?
Well, there wasn't Ryanair, so he didn't come that way. We're talking about a monk called Aidan, who comes over from Iona, from the Scottish coast, at the invitation of the local king. And that's a good thing, really, because if you're wanting to establish a religion in an area, you want to be kind of at the seat of power, and Aidan was. So he comes in, as you say, 634, 635, sometime like that. Sounds like a long time ago. And sets up on what we now know as Holy Island.
So is he the most important monk associated with Lindisfarne?
There's a whole string of really impressive people. And the next one is Cuthbert, who was a soldier and then became a monk. And he comes to Lindisfarne in 670, so kind of 35 years later, something like that. And he comes again at the invitation of the king, and he becomes known as not just a great leader, but somebody who really embodies the Christian faith. So he is humble, he lives a life of simplicity, but with great empathy, and he exhibits great tolerance. And at his death, there's a coffin in the church in the priory on Lindisfarne, and 11 years later, I mean, really, I don't know why. Somebody comes up with a great idea. Let's open the coffin and see how he's doing. You know, you'd think they've got enough to do. But anyway, so they open the coffin and lo and behold, Cuthbert's remains had not deteriorated. And this was taken as a sign of his great sanctity and bushkumpf. You know, instantly you get this is a place of pilgrimage.
Could have just been sealed in lead. I don't mean to be disparaging, but Catherine Parr's remains were opened in the 18th century and she was still intact as well. And I don't think she's a saint.
No, well, that was probably it, but there we are.
But the Lindisfarne Gospels, however, if any listeners haven't seen them, you really must when the opportunity arises. So how were these produced? Tell me about them, Joe.
These kinds of manuscripts were partly an act of religious devotion in themselves, the sheer manufacturing of them, the fact that they're incredibly time consuming to produce, that they cost a lot of money. You've got to have the resources. I mean, this is why you've got the king involved. This is all about land ownership and control of the area. And just, we are so used to our communications and our art being almost instantaneous these days. I love that sense of the extraordinary patience required to produce them.
And it was one man, just one man doing this as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, just quietly working away. And remember also, because we're talking about there being no artificial light whatsoever, except for maybe some candles where probably not good enough. You're talking about daylight hours, summertime there for what, 12, 13, 14 hours, wintertime, what, 5? Probably not at all.
Yes, and somewhere that if you wanted to go outside to get the best light, you know, you're probably facing the problems of the weather.
Pretty windy. And I mean, I love it up under this farm. It's one of my favourite places in the whole of the country. But yeah, it's never very calm weather up there.
And it is amazing. So it was a man called Bishop Eadfrith who did the work. And it predates the history that we have by the Venerable Bede of this ancient manuscript about the English church. So we're talking about something really, really precious. And they're such a beautiful artefact, these Lindisfarne Gospels, aren't they?
And incredible things to look at to this day. And when first produced, the colours would have been so incredibly rich and ornate. This thing would have been the most colourful, extraordinary thing anyone would have seen probably in their lifetime.
There's a real movement, understandably, by campaigners in the Northeast to have them moved back home. But why do they have such an important place in the history of English faith?
Well, because they are one man's life's work. And why did he dedicate his life to this? Because this was the most important message that he could get over to anybody.
And there's something in that, isn't it? The production of the Gospels or of the buildings that we're talking about, the painstaking work, the energy, the labour that has gone into creating them, and the tiny details of effort that, you know, that someone has put in shows such dedication to faith in a way that we don't perhaps see all the time these days. Well, at the time of their creation, Northumbria was a real melting pot of beliefs. It's not for certain that Christianity, originally introduced by the Romans, would be the dominant faith in England. Instead, non-Christian Saxons, Vikings and Angles would all tussle for dominance in the as yet unrecognisable Britain. In short, you can trace modern Christianity in England back to turning points like this, where decisions were taken on the practices of English Christianity and where one monk chose to record religious history. Our third and final location for this episode sees us staying in the northeast of England, near the village of Holystone, a name which gives you some hint about the place we're about to visit. The very Reverend Dr. David Ison selected Ladies' Well, which is a very atmospheric, peaceful spot, steeped in religious tradition. The well is fed by a natural spring that supplies the nearby village with water. You can visit the well yourself by following a footpath to a quiet pool that sits amongst a grove of trees. At the eastern end of the well is a flat stone, once thought to be used for baptisms, which gave Holystone Village its name. This is what our judge had to say.
Holy wells go back, as we know, again, millennia, in terms of the life-giving nature of wells and springs. And they were hugely important to people as a means of survival, and therefore a way into spiritual experience of saying we receive this water as a gift. It's, you can't take it for granted, it might dry up someday. But also there is something very generative about this. And in the same way that the crops grow in spring, the leaves of trees come out and so on, there is part of the cycle of nature that says water is really important. And so the holiness of places where water comes to the surface, again, living on the edge of things where two different worlds collide, is a place where there's more access to the spiritual. And it shows the continuity of that tradition of holy places around water, which have continued to our own day. And people still throw money into springs and wells.
So let's talk about the holy heritage of this well. Back in the 12th century, a priory existed in Holystone and was home to eight Augustinian canonesses. They gave the site its name, Ladies' Well. Is this the earliest reference we have to Ladies' Well, Joe?
We've got Roman references as well. And I'm going to throw this one out there, that my personal view is a site like this has almost certainly got prehistoric origins. So many of these sites up and down the country, in fact, have been in use, just as David said earlier, millennia of use. The fact that we perhaps can't prove a prehistoric link, you look at the kind of landscape, fresh water is one of those places which anywhere you go, these sites become venerated very early on.
And Hazel, these springs have a history of baptism associated with them. Tell us about that.
That's right. Back in the 5th century, a Celtic missionary called St. Ninian is said to have baptised people in this pool. But I think Joe's right. You know, could have been before that and certainly after that. So you get a confluence, don't you, of physical refreshment and spiritual refreshment coming together.
We have from the 7th century another saint, St. Paulinus, who's said to have baptised 3,000 Christians over the Easter week, leaning on the stone that is now the holy stone we mentioned earlier.
And 3,000 Christians is so many people.
It's going to take a while, isn't it?
Well, yes, it's going to take a while. But you know, allegedly it took a week. But more than that, it's so many people. That's probably all the people from the surrounding area and further. You know, it's not just a small town. It's just vast.
And you're right. And if you think about how early it is in the history of Christianity in this country as well, it's a real step change, I suppose. If you think we're 30 years after Augustine comes to Canterbury, it's actually pretty important in terms of the changing nature of faith in the country.
Yes, you can imagine if there was an event like that where you lived and everybody from the surrounding area was baptised. That changes everything. That changes everything you believe, everything that you are, how you relate to each other, how you see where you live.
And I think there's something interesting about how this has meant something to generations as well, because there's a 15th century statue of St Paulinus on a stone at Ladieswell. And there's also a monument, which is a cross in the Celtic style from the Victorian period, which was put into the pool. And so there's a sense that people have made their mark and that this has meant something to generation after generation.
Yeah, I mean, water is sacred to practically every religion and tradition. You know, you have Ladieswell, you have Lourdes, you have the Ganges in India. And there's the sense that water is a miracle, it is life-giving, it's sacred, it's purifying. And there's this interesting connection as well between women and water. So you have the canonesses at Ladieswell. And also, from my own Islamic tradition, there's the story of the miracle of the Zamzam spring that sprung up in the desert. And that is connected with Hagar, Abraham's wife, or Hajar in the Arabic. And that's part of now the rituals of the Islamic pilgrimage. So millions of pilgrims will reenact her steps looking for the water when she was rushing between the hills to give water to her baby. And pilgrims will drink it to this day. So there is a very, very important connection between women and water and how they've nurtured religious practices.
That's really interesting. And the other thing I was really struck by, Joe, was the sense that David talked about the kind of liminality, the edge of being on the edge of things, that you're a place betwixt and between at somewhere like Ladieswell, and that those places are particularly useful places to engage with spirituality. Can you think of any other comparisons?
There's so many of these holy wells are often in these quite secretive, perhaps, spaces. You will often, I mean, obviously the topography partly lends itself to it, with water creating little hollows, the trees clustering around them, particularly in places like bits of the northeast of the country, where you do have this kind of this warp and weave landscape. But then you can go to other places like Walsingham, the famous pilgrimage site in Norfolk, where there, again, up on that very wet but very kind of flat landscape, where you've got real sense of routeways on these kind of places, of millennia of people moving through a landscape, following the same routes, following the same signs.
And we all need places of refreshment like that from time to time. Well, that's it for now. Thank you, Hazel, Ramona and Joe, for taking us through three such intriguing places that tell us about England's story of faith and belief. But there are seven more to go. Can you guess which we'll feature next time? Make sure you subscribe and join us for the next step of the journey. I'm Susanna Lipscomb. Thanks for joining me. I'll catch you next time.
This is a Historic England podcast, sponsored by Ecclesiastical Insurance Group. When it feels irreplaceable, trust Ecclesiastical.